All right, Christopher here. Welcome to Do Explain. Before we begin, I'd like to thank my current supporters who inspire me to carry on with this project and make it financially viable as well. I'm very grateful to all of you. Big hugs. And while I'm not in the business of telling people what to do, I can share my vision for Do Explain going forward. I like to work on the podcast full-time instead of just a few days a month. I want to build a real platform for the fun and friendly exchange of interesting ideas, and I want to do it ad-free, if possible, because I don't want any ideas to be off-limits for us to explore, and I also want to keep saying dumb shit without repercussions. But to do this, I'll need a steady income, and that's why I need your help. So if you enjoy what I'm doing here, and you want to join me in my vision and become a part of growing this project, consider going over to patreon.com/doexplain and sign up to become a monthly supporter. All right, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. All right, so I'm here with Michael Golding. Michael, welcome back to the podcast. I'm delighted.
Hi, Christopher. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. And last time you were on, I spent a good 10 minutes or so berating you with psychiatrist jokes. And of course, I didn't have time to ask you about nearly half of what I wanted to ask you. So I thought that while we can keep that playful vibe there underlying the whole conversation, I just wanted to get straight to the good stuff and see where we end up.
Perfect.
All right. So last time I asked you about how you view psychiatry as a field and what it is that you do. And I'm curious, I didn't get to ask you last time what it looks like when a psychiatrist make a diagnosis. And I thought that'd be a cool entry point. So if you could just tell us how do you diagnose a patient? How does that look in practice?
It's a good question because it's extraordinarily complex process, and it, in general, doesn't happen after just one visit, and all diagnoses are subject to change. They're tentative. Hmm. Certainly, for the first time we see somebody, we almost always put a list of rule-outs. Now, when someone walks into the room, every aspect of their behavior and presentation is something to be noticed. For example, the way someone walks can give one an indication about various neurological conditions. The strength of their handshake, the degree to which they're attending to you. Dr. Roger Maltby was a professor of ours at the University of North Carolina. He used to enable us to listen to literally 10 seconds of a 1 or 2 hour interview, and he'd stop the tape, and you literally had enough time to see the person walk in and maybe say 1 or 2 words.
Hmm.
And then they'd ask you what your differential is and what you think is most likely. Now, I'm even now not that good, but he could get a very, very accurate differential diagnosis within 10 seconds because of the incredibly detailed sort of observation that goes on. But suffice to say that any given behavior or symptom or lab that a patient may have probably has several thousand diagnoses associated with it. So a symptom like problem with sleep or sadness, they're not one or two things that one is thinking about. It's literally thousands. How can one think about thousands of diagnoses? What one does is one goes through a process of ruling things out. For example, one might rule out metabolic effects. Is this person's fatigue due to hypothyroidism or sleep apnea? Is this person's appetite problem? By the way, I'm listing symptoms of depression.
Yeah.
Is this person's appetite problem due to a cancer of the stomach or hyperthyroidism? Is this person's lack of energy due to a low-grade viral illness, which produces some of the same, what are called cytokines, chemicals that make one tired that depression does? And so psychiatric diagnosis is a process of ruling out from a whole series of thousands of diagnoses from any given symptom or behavior down to a series of them and then doing various sorts of tests and other sorts of interventions to try to narrow it down further. So essentially, psychiatric diagnosis is done the same way that medical diagnosis is done, and the same illnesses very frequently need to be considered.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. It sounds like it is inherently Popperian in its methods. But I'm wondering then, because it must be incredibly hard to distinguish between, I'd imagine that many people have both, because physiological issues can lead to, if you have low energy, and low energy makes you unable to do the things that you want, the low energy is due to physiological markers to begin with, but then that makes you really sad and upset because you cannot live your life the way you want to because you're too tired, which in turn will exacerbate the fatigue because it's not good to feel really down all the time. That will have physiological effects of its own. And I mean, how do you untangle the medical from the psychological? It seems like that's somewhat impossible.
I think I agree with you that to perfectly come up with explanatory theories, at least at this point, is for all practical purposes impossible. And so one starts where one is. For example, if someone is fatigued, we're going to be running a whole lot of different both blood tests as well as asking a whole lot of questions to rule out a number of different neurological conditions. Is this early MS? Is this certain subcortical strokes in certain parts of the brain? Is this a frontal lobe tumor, which could, depending upon where it is, both cause attention deficit hyperactivity or fatigue and apathy? There are any number of different ways, but one starts somewhere in terms of ruling things out. And it's interesting that drugs like antidepressants, for the most part, don't care whether one is reacting to a physiological state that is making one tired, for example, or whether one isn't. And let me give you an example of why that might be so. In rats, we test various drugs to see if they're antidepressants, but one of the ways is by putting a rat in a pool of water and not allowing it to stand. Things which are antidepressants, regardless of the psychiatric condition of the rat, because as far as we know, rats don't have specifically psychiatric conditions.
It's a rat. Isn't that horrible enough, Michael?
Right, exactly. I know. Right. The mind of a rat. I mean, it's an interesting question. What is the mind of a rat? But an antidepressant, including electroconvulsive therapy or lithium, will uniformly make that rat not give up as easily. Now, there are what one might call, I euphemistically call, and I'm joking a bit when I say this, so please don't take me too seriously. There are sort of Buddhist antidepressants, and there are capitalist antidepressants. I say that to patients to help them understand what might make a rat swim more. A capitalist antidepressant might be, there are certain varieties that are more stimulating, and that might cause the rat to say, if the rat could speak, and I'm speaking, of course, very metaphorically, "You gosh darn experimenter, I friggin' hate you. I'll show you. You're trying to drown me. I'm going to swim and swim and swim forever, you mother whatever." That might be an example of a capitalist antidepressant. And I'm, of course, just playing on sort of a raw, rugged capitalism. And I'm very much into capitalism myself, so I'm not meaning to disparage free trade of ideas and goods.
Yeah, of course.
Then there's what one might call a Buddhist antidepressant. A Buddhist antidepressant might be those that are actually sort of inhibitors of what's called the anterior cingulate and the amygdala. And a Buddhist antidepressant might be saying metaphorically to the brain, and if the rat could speak, he or she might say back, "Ooh, you would like me to swim a bit more? Why, okay. I'll be very, very happy to do so. No problem. Let me get on with it then." But in either case, the rat will swim more before giving up. Now, both of those states can be simulated in people with various changes in physiology and with various physical states. For example, an extreme Buddhist state is a very dangerous state. If one has a stroke in the anterior cingulate, which is what SSRIs do, they inhibit the anterior cingulate. These individuals will, and a guy by the name of Critchley did some fascinating work with them. He had these guys and gals speak in public. Now, normally when you speak in public, your blood pressure goes up, your heart rate goes up, your stress hormones go up. And indeed, I know a good bit about this because my research was precisely doing this to college students and heart patients. So one could say I tortured college students and heart patients for research.
Nice. Fun.
But of course, these were the kindest, most wonderful, gentle people who allowed us to learn. So that, you know, I don't really think we were torturing them, and we were very, very grateful for their service and help. But when individuals have stroke to this part of the brain, they don't in any way feel stressed when they're speaking in public, and their physiology in no way reacts, completely flat. I mean, I have a slide of this, which is pretty funny, with these people with these holes in their brain in particular areas. And then when they speak in public, they don't react. And so that would be an extreme version of the Buddhist antidepressant. The person doesn't react at all to stress. And that's an entirely physiochemical kind of thing. And somehow both the psychology of it, the feeling, as well as the physiology, both are toned down with lesions here. Indeed, people used to give people cingulotomies as a therapeutic treatment. Nowadays, we are not doing surgery on it, but people are implanting electrodes into that part of the brain so that people can push a button and get that sense of a calm physically. And that lack of reactivity. And there have been, Helen Mayfield, I think I mentioned this on the last podcast, did some really interesting studies with this. And if sham pushes of the button will not make the person feel relaxed, the person never knows whether the button is being pressed or not. But when you have them fill out rating scales at various points in time, when you've been periodically pushing the button, the person will say that they're feeling relaxed and calm, and their physiology is not reacting. And when you're not pushing the button, they don't. And in no case, the brain doesn't have, sensory receptors to know when the thing is being pressed or not. And so these are not placebo responses. So an antidepressant, in that sense, is something that can act in multiple different ways. And so the original question, I think, was about how do you rule various illnesses out? And the answer is that the antidepressant works in a variety of different situations because it works even in someone with no particular physiological derangement. And so in that sense, one can start by helping someone to feel better when there's a complex problem of explanatory causality. So your example was that someone had a physiological reaction. Let me give you an example of that. When people have a viral illness, their macrophages, which are a type of immune cell, give off various things called cytokines, which I mentioned earlier, like interleukin-6 and tumor necrosis factor. We don't know exactly.
Inflammatory markers, right?
Yeah, inflammatory mediators, I would say. They are markers, but they're also mediators. They actually cause you to feel really bad and foggy and horrible. Now, perhaps evolutionarily, I don't know, this is a bit speculative. But perhaps evolutionarily, when you're sick, you probably shouldn't be running around. The body needs to focus its energies on healing. Perhaps you should rest. And so evolutionarily, we created a sick feeling so that one stays in bed. And that's people guess that. I don't know whether that's so. But it turns out that depression itself creates those exact same inflammatory markers as a viral illness. So does one want to say that the fatigue from a viral illness and the sickness from a viral illness is something real and physical, but the depression somehow isn't, though both are using some of the same physiological mediators to induce their effect? And the answer is no. And in all cases, when the antidepressant works, it is reducing much of these inflammatory markers. It's also, to relate it back to the example of the anterior cingulate, it's also inhibiting the anterior cingulate. And by the way, to relate it back to a discussion that we had previously, which I don't really want to talk about in too much detail, but with hallucinogens, in an extreme sense, these also inhibit in a much stronger and, in my view, more dangerous way, this type of emotional reactivity. And so people are more turning inward and they're not reacting to external stimuli as much.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff there. And you actually touched on several things that I want to discuss further. And one of those is, you mentioned the Buddhist antidepressant there. Are these terms that you have coined, that distinction?
Yeah, that's mine. SSRIs are anti-obsessionals. So they decrease one's, there's a loop between various parts of the brain that neurosurgically we still cut in extreme cases of OCD. And that loop adds salience. It's part of what's called the salience network. And that loop adds salience to a given thought, which then asks one to think more about it, which then adds more salience to it in a sort of a positive feedback loop that creates obsessions. Certain antidepressants will work to decrease obsessional thinking. SSRIs will. People think psychedelics do as well. And in extreme cases, neurosurgery. By the way, it's not a definitive treatment. There are apparently different types of OCD, but in a very large percentage of patients in these worst cases, and it's very rarely done, the surgery works to stop this obsessional thinking and this positive feedback loop.
Right. If anything, from what you said there, it seems like that would support that it's even harder to differentiate between what it's actually causing. Is it ideas causing these symptoms primarily? Is it physiology? And I'm wondering, a lot of people would criticize psychology as a somewhat explanationless field, where it seems like much of it is saying that intervention X seems to work, so let's do more of that, but we don't really seem to have a fundamental grasp of the underlying mechanism or mechanisms behind these things much of the time. So how do you respond to that critique? Is psychiatry and psychology essentially an explanationless field? And if yes, what do we do about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are aspects of the field which are absolutely explanationless. I would say that that's true in medicine as well. But let me just point out that before we had a theory of relativity and Newtonian mechanics, and therefore, I guess primarily Newtonian mechanics, and therefore a theory of architectural construction and engineering, people still built many, 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 many beautiful churches. Now, many of those churches fell. Now, how did people work without good underlying universal explanations? Well, they guessed, and they used rules of thumb, and they pieced together over centuries very, very beautiful architectural masterpieces, churches and things. Now, perhaps back then, if a church fell, it would not be too surprising if someone were doing something new, because people didn't really have an explanation of what would make something stand. Nowadays, as I think Professor Deutsch pointed this out, or at least one of our Popperian colleagues did, nowadays, if a new bit of construction is created that looks nothing like any previous bit of construction, we all have the full expectation that it will stand, and indeed it will, and if it doesn't, somebody is going to be sued. The reason that's so is because we can be more creative now once we have a theory, an underlying universal explanatory theory. We don't at present of artificial intelligence and mind. We don't have really good explanatory theories of why one person with a certain amount and colony count of bacteria kills the bacteria and survives, and someone else with a seemingly identical colony count doesn't. But we know that in both cases, probably the smart thing to do would be to give an antibiotic, since we can't predict. We don't know why, in some cases, someone with cancer in some of their cells will be relatively straightforwardly taken care of by our own immune system. But we can't really explain why it works in them, but not in someone else. We don't really have excellent theories of many, many aspects of medicine, let alone we don't have excellent theories of what causes a migraine headaches. But anyone doubts its existence or that we can help to treat a migraine headache is very much mistaken. We treat it all the time, even though we have no really understanding of what suffering and pain means in a mental state. Nonetheless, we're able to treat these conditions so that people say that they feel better. We've learned this through rules of thumb.
But when you say treat, we're talking mostly about dampening symptoms in both cases a lot of the time, wouldn't you say? Rather than actually, you know, finding the underlying cause and solving the root issue.
I think I prefer the language of explanation than cause. And if you're interested in why in medicine I prefer explanation rather than cause, it's a slightly separate discussion. But if you're saying that we can't find the underlying explanation, I think that that is true. And after all, if we did have underlying explanations of things, then there would be no such thing as virtually any physical or so-called mental illness. For example, you gave in the last podcast a situation in which you were being stabbed in the back and bleeding. If we really had an underlying explanation of what was going on there, we would be able to create nanobots that would completely and totally fix you immediately. And indeed, knife play might be something fun to do, to learn about what knife play is like, because it would in no way be dangerous and you would not be physically ill. The great pathologist Virchow, who incidentally is thought of highly by Thomas Sowers, basically pointed out that dead people have no diseases. Even if a person is riddled with infection and riddled with cancer, it doesn't cause that person as a rational person to think that there's a problem because there's no person there. So in the case of you bleeding out, if there were nanobots, it would only occur if you chose not to avail yourself of the nanobots. And that would be a problem, presumably, of your rational thinking rather than a physical illness per se, because the environmental context would completely protect you. So I would say that this issue between mental and physical is a bit of a misnomer. Any illness is one in which there's a physical change, which would cause a rational person to be concerned about it, or an unconscious, if you will, disorganization of ideas, which would cause a rational person to be concerned about it. The third category is conscious ideas, which would cause a rational person to be concerned about it. Those are much less involved in medicine, although we certainly discuss them. But something like the latter category might be someone saying that I support terrorism because the United States is evil. That would be sort of the political thing. Those who are critics of psychiatry think that the only thing that psychiatrists do is deal with voluntary ideas that a rational person would have problems with. Thus, psychiatry is about politics and morality rather than medicine, and that's just a canard. It's an untruth. I think it says more about the people who are saying it than not, and I don't mean to be harsh, because I think people can innocently make mistakes, but it's just not the stuff of medicine. Medicine is dealing with involuntary sorts of behaviors and symptoms, whether those are precipitated by unconscious ideas or by physical changes. In some sense, it doesn't matter, since, as I've pointed out, there is a very intimate relationship between both. If one is oblivious to that, or if one thinks that that sounds strange, imagine something like, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, and I think maybe on the listener notes, I'll need to define it a little bit better, but it's something called Takubatsu's cardiomyopathy, which is a situation in which, because of deep and profound grief, an individual will literally suffer heart failure. And they can die from that. They usually don't if you give them supportive care, but people think, for example, that voodoo deaths are due to this kind of thing. And so disorganized, problematic, unconscious ideas physically kill you as quickly as a change in a physical state can kill you. And both a change in one's ideas and a change in one's physical state can improve all of that, because a change in one's ideas changes the context of the physical illness, which changes the physiology. And the change in the physiology changes what one's mind can and should focus on. So both are relevant.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's extremely fascinating, the interplay between physiology and psychology. And I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about that last podcast, and you mentioned so many things there, Michael. It's like the word I was looking for last time. We're at a crossroads where I have to choose between five almost equally enticing paths to travel down here with you. So I'm just going to have to pick somewhat randomly, but I just want to clarify first. You said something about someone being having ideas of terrorism, being a terrorist, wanting to bomb America, let's say, and fight jihad. That person, and I know Sam Harris stresses this point a lot, that he thinks that most of those people are sane people in the sense that they are normal people who simply have bad conscious ideas, as you mentioned there. But they can coherently reason. They make sense to themselves. They have a inherently coherent logical structure to their beliefs there, even if the axioms that they start with are completely false. But that's a fundamental difference for someone who is disorganized at an unconscious level where their own narrative doesn't even make internal sense. There's no coherent structure to it. And as we discussed last time, it's, yeah, the association between horse and moon is just as clear as between car and tire for them. Is that the fundamental difference between someone who just really has the wrong ideas and have the immoral ideas but still functions as a person and someone who is deemed clinically insane?
Yes, and I think you state it well, and those are the two extremes. And I
right.
think the common word that people want to use in that context is that in the former case, the person's behavior is voluntary in some sense. And in the latter case, the person's behavior is less than voluntary, at least in certain domains. The interesting thing is that people can be coherent in one domain, but biologically destroying knowledge in another. Kind of like if one were to use the analogy that I did last time, one can have cancer in some cells, which are destroying structure and organization, but not cancer in other cells. And I think it's really a mistake to say either a person is completely rational and problem-solving, or he or she is not. I could go through multiple examples where both exist simultaneously if you want. I won't, because I sense that there are other questions here. Go ahead.
But then I want to ask you, because if we adopt your theory of schizophrenia, for example, and we say that's a cancer of the mind, and ultimately it's a matter of not being able to error correct as fast as the problems are accumulating. So you can't effectively create the knowledge to solve your problems, and hence you are fucked, to be blunt. If you can't error correct and problem solve at all, then how would you be able to make sense in any area? What do you mean when you say that a person can make sense in one area but not in another?
Let me give you several examples that might help to elucidate that, some from maybe our own experience. And I'll give you two examples from last time we spoke, and I can give a few others too. Let's say that a person is asleep and dreaming. Certainly there is a creativity involved in one's thinking. So, for example, one is able to imagine a dentist, maybe even a circuit board, and how it works. But in that dream, one is not aware that one is dreaming. Hmm. One is not, in a sense, conscious of one's consciousness. But when one is awake, one is aware that there's an awake state and a dreaming state. And so we're able to exercise our creativity in one realm. But in another, when we see a burglar enter our study where we're examining our circuit with human-level intelligence in our dream, We may think that burglar is going to attack us in a nightmare, and we may kick the burglar. Evolution, as we talked about last time, paralyzes us during our dreams so that we don't act them out. But in some cases, people have REM behavioral disorder, and they might actually kick their bed partner. So there's a situation where someone is creating knowledge in one area, but not creating knowledge in another. Let me give you several more examples that might help make this clear. There are different ways in which biology can interfere with the mind and thinking. If there were not, then one drug would be all that one needs to fix one's mind. There are interference that might cause a depression-type problem in thinking. There is interference that might cause a hit-in-the-head sort of problem with thinking. There are medicines that might affect interference with conjecturing and criticizing, like on an unconscious level. So the fact that different drugs work differently means that there are different types of interference with thinking. And you can see that very clearly. Here's just a more prosaic example just from my own experience. I have very, very bad taste buds, and it's very difficult for me to distinguish various tastes. For example, when I drink whiskey or even food, I have a lot of trouble understanding it. But one thing I do have is a very good musical sense. And without my even knowing it, I started describing to my wife tastes in terms of pitches and staccato tendency. And I actually have used that to learn a bit. My view is that given enough time, that musical sense could morph into quite a good palate in terms of understanding things and maybe be as good as someone who primarily is able to have good taste buds and thinking skills. But to the extent that, say, my nose receptors and nasal and various, taste buds, I'll use that word, to the extent that my taste buds are not as finely developed and the receptors are not as finely developed in certain other ways, then I'm going to have more trouble than the average person, even with my musical skills. Similarly, someone in the ICU we talked about last time who had a lung transplant, and then 50% of the time that person is hallucinating, but they may well be hallucinating about something using human level intelligence. They may be imagining a dragon that is operating a circuit board. I don't imagine many animals do that. But so that aspect of their thinking may well be error correcting. Another aspect of their thinking, namely that the dragon and the devil is trying to kill them, is not error correcting. And they may try to pull out their IVs and their breathing tube. So one could say, well, is it a person or is it not a person? And the answer is, of course, it's a person. Even if the person were comatose, that would be a person because it would be someone with potential. But how about right then at the moment? Is that person exhibiting rational thinking or not rational thinking? Well, it surely is both. In some domains, they're able to think rationally, in others they're not. Now, is it true that if one lived long enough, that the ability to learn anything would mean the ability to learn everything? Well, if one's a Popperian, the answer to that, and a Deutschian Popperian, the answer to that is yes. But we don't live for forever. And it's kind of like saying, you know, in this war between, if you will, the cancer of the mind, which is destroying knowledge, and other aspects of the mind, which is creating knowledge, which wins? And it's not at all clear which does. In the case of the ICU patient, who is hallucinating about very, very interesting and fascinating human-level things, but is completely wrong about the context and thinks the doctor is trying to kill him. The irrational mind will win if a doctor doesn't restrain the person to the bed and give the person IV Haldol, which is, of course, the same medication that is used to treat schizophrenia in a different context. Somehow it works in both, very interestingly in my view. You know, they're both very different sorts of situations. It suggests there's some underlying mechanism of problem. I think it's slowing down unconscious conjectures. But the fact that different drugs work means that there's different types of interference. And if there's different types of interference, then some sorts of interference can stop one from doing one activity but not another. It's a very, in my view, sadly simplistic thing to say, well, either you think correctly or you don't. That doesn't make sense. There are multiple aspects of the mind. And a more nuanced view takes that into account.
So let's talk therapies for a moment. I want to know, what do we know so far when it comes to different therapeutic modalities, and what forms of therapy are reliably useful for different ailments? And can we differentiate between them? Are there ones that are better, ones that don't work at all? Like, where do we stand at this point? Is there a best therapy overall? What do we know about therapies?
I think there are a lot of different therapies that work. What many studies seem to suggest is that if an individual maintains a sense of boundaries, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and a sense of compassion for the individual whom he or she is with, a variety of different therapies tend to work well. And it's not obvious that one must be better than the other. Certain types of therapies are better studied in certain regards. Perhaps the best studied modality is cognitive behavioral therapy, which has very good corroborating evidence refuting that it doesn't work, maybe to say it that way. And so I think in a lot of scenarios, people use that. But someone who is just going through the motions, helping someone to organize their thinking better according to their own lights, is not going to do very much if there's not a sense of compassion and a sense of bonding with the patient. And so I think a lot of things work, and I'm comfortable with using a lot in different scenarios, and happy to talk about individual ones if you like. I don't think any of them are magic bullets because ultimately I'm not utopian. I don't think either drugs or therapy are per se the solution to people's problems. Ultimately, individuals have to grow their own emotional and intellectual knowledge. They have to guess. They have to criticize. And as you know, in a Popperian framework, guesses will always be imperfect, and one's criticisms of those guesses will always be imperfect. But knowledge grows in that systematic way of making a guess, a theory about something, and then seeing if there are problems with it, and if there are, adjusting the theory and improving. And I think that's ultimately what works. If someone, you know, on some level doesn't want to engage with that, then I don't think any amount of drugs or any amount of therapy is going to fix that. That's not to say that someone really has to believe that what you're doing. They just have to have a part of them that says, well, maybe this could work. Even if another part is saying out loud, I've been sick for all my life and nothing can help me. As long as there's a little part that's willing to stay with the therapist and the doctor, a person can get better. And that's true for most people. I've rarely met someone who really wants to be miserable.
Yeah. And that person would be objectively wrong in any sense. But
yeah, life is wonderful. That's right.
Yeah. Well, it can be. And we should strive to make it so. But I think that it's interesting to think of therapy from the lens of epistemology and critical rationalism. And Popper's bucket theory of mind here seems to be very important. In the context of therapy, I would imagine that many people think that the therapist is there to fix you and fix your problems for you. Maybe I'm strawmanning most people. I don't know if they think that, but I've thought like that before, that it's something that the therapist is doing that's fixing my mind, rather than thinking that it's more a matter of the therapist getting you to stop doubting your own ability to solve the problems that are causing you the pain, and perhaps creating an atmosphere and a context where you feel safe to explore and guess different solutions to this problem. And I think that you told me once when we spoke privately that when I asked you something similar about therapies, which ones are the best ones, I think you said that studies currently show that it's not that much difference in general between what therapy you use, but there's a tremendous difference between what therapist you have in the sense of, what characteristics do they have? And you mentioned compassion there for one. So is that something that you would subscribe to? The idea that, yeah, what the therapist is really doing, if he's any good or she, is creating a safe context for the person to problem solve themselves. And maybe they can also help by contributing with well-placed criticisms in a kindly manner, which would facilitate the problem solving of the person. But am I anyway in the ballpark here, or is it rambling?
No, sir. I think you're completely accurate. A therapist is providing a context, and I think it's a bit of another canard about our field that we are trying to control the minds of people to have them behave in socially acceptable ways. Quite the opposite. It is conceivable, and I've had sort of situations like this where I might be treating, for example, someone with Nazi tendencies, and my medical responsibility isn't to change their mind, to say that Jews are not evil people and that blacks are not evil people. That really isn't my purpose. If they're depressed, my goal is to help them more coherently achieve their highest goals, which may very much disagree with mine dramatically. Nonetheless, I'll treat their depression. I hope that compassion and decent interaction with someone might change their mind about wanting to kill people. But as their psychiatrist, I don't see it as my job to do that. I'm not trying to control people, quite the opposite. I'm trying to help them think and control themselves. And I think that's another misconception about the field.
Would you say it's fair that historically psychiatry had more of this vein to it, even if I would agree completely that today the absolute majority of psychiatrists are really good people truly wanting to help their patients, like you're saying? It has nothing to do with control. But does it make sense to talk about it historically at certain stages of the field?
I think so. I mean, I think there certainly were general medical physicians as well as psychiatrists who were very controlling and awful in terms of what they historically did to people. There certainly were many doctors who were complicit in the Third Reich in killing and injuring people and using the imprimatur of medical science to justify what they were doing. These were horrible, horrible moral decisions. So I think it is quite possible that, and not only possible, likely, that terrible experiments were done by physicians that injured people and did not take into account their rights and their need to be free and independent thinkers and people. Are there bad psychiatrists now? Surely there are. And we try to root them out as much as we possibly can.
Yeah. So to stay on the topic of different therapies, can you give some examples of certain mental ailments where a certain form of therapy is the most effective treatment, and where drugs combined with therapy is most efficient, and perhaps the third category of where, therapy isn't useful at all, and it's all a matter of using drugs to kickstart the healing process?
Sure. A whole lot of anxiety disorders are best treated with pure psychotherapy. For example, if I have someone in my office who has what's called panic disorder, these are individuals who have out of the blue experiences where they start shaking and sweating and their heart races, and many of them interpret that they're going to die. Now, this might indeed be due to a physiological problem. Some people say, for example, that the carotid arch chemoreceptors are overly sensitive to carbon dioxide. So this was a theory by the name of Dr. Klein. So maybe if you get a little too much carbon dioxide, it feels like an exaggerated smother response, and you start hyperventilating, which instigates panic. And then once one starts perceiving, as you talked about earlier, that one's heart is racing, then that says, oh my goodness, that must mean I'm going to die. And that continues the psychological fear, which then makes the physiology worse, et cetera, et cetera. So for panic disorder, pure panic disorder, there are a lot of medications that work well, but therapy is a very, very useful technique and often can be exclusively done and the best. I mean, what I used to do with patients is we would practice having panic attacks. And I would induce them in the office by, for example, and I'm not recommending that people do this, but because they might seize, for example, and I would do it in the doctor's office. But for example, I would have them hyperventilate and I would do it with them. And as they hyperventilated, that triggers a panic-like reaction if you do it long enough. Or even better, you can put them in a chair, have them hyperventilate and spin the chair. And then they'll hyperventilate. So then you have a panic attack. And so then you have all this physiology going on around you. Your heart is racing and you're sweating. And then you say, oh my goodness, look, we're having a panic attack. Are we going to die here? And I often would have it with them and I'd do it with them. Our face would turn red. And when someone got better, I might even have them leave the office and walk around. And we might even say hello to a person on the street. While we're red-faced, usually we'd pick men, not women, so they didn't feel afraid of these two crazy red-faced, hyperventilating individuals.
We should have started the podcast like this, Michael.
Right, absolutely, and made ourselves crazy in doing it.
So is that a form of exposure therapy in CBT style?
Yeah, it's a form of behavioral exposure therapy and learning to enjoy having a panic attack. And
right. So it's a contextual reframing of that feeling.
I one time had a panic attack while I was giving a talk in public, actually a paid talk in public. Mm. And I literally said to the audience, because I had had some training in this, I just said, look, right now your speaker is having a panic attack. That means I'm going to, and I encourage patients to do something likewise, that means I'm going to shake. I'm going to sweat. My voice may sound a little bit tremulous, but regardless, I want to deliver the very best presentation I can. If you bear with me, I'm going to continue. Now, there are horrible people potentially in a room who would say this is a terrible speaker, but almost universally, people are not such awful people. They have compassion. They listen, and you get through it. And often, you know, the evaluations from the speech can be perfectly fine. In fact, people might even say it was absolutely remarkable, and did on some of the evaluations, what happened there. And I appreciate your being honest with us. And I think a lot, that's the kind of thing of learning to, are you really going to die from this panic attack? Is this really going to kill you? So even if there is a physiological tripwire, let's say Dr. Klein is correct that the carotid chemoreceptors are overly sensitive to carbon dioxide, triggering a smother response. And indeed, you can induce panic by injecting lactic acid and other sorts of things in people and very predictably cause it. And indeed, you can test various meds to treat panic disorder by injecting various compounds, creating panic attacks, and seeing which drugs will deal with them. And people do things like that. But happily, one can induce it behaviorally, learn to deal with it. So that would be an example. There are many more examples of that. Various types of anxiety disorders, which are very well treated with behavioral interventions, cognitive interventions. Social phobia can be another one. In someone with very serious major depression, you're really going to want to use an antidepressant and therapy as well. You're going to want to do both. Hmm. And studies repeatedly show that the two together are better than each individually. And then, of course, there are some situations in which it's not that therapy is not needed. I don't think there's ever a situation in which kindness and compassion and showing up and being there for the person is
bad for them.
Yeah. If someone can't really hear you because they're catatonic and they're literally rigid, or they have major depression with psychotic features, or they're hallucinating, really the only thing they can sometimes hear is the compassion in your voice, which, as I said, different aspects of the mind hear different things. You try to reason with someone, you're appealing to a part of the mind that is not error correcting when you're using language and speech. On the other hand, if you're using compassion, that part of the mind that understands that often can still hear. And if you will, there is no bucket theory of the mind. That part of the mind emotionally conjectures, if you will, that this person is kind and safe. I'm reminded of a patient at one of the hospitals just screaming and yelling and throwing things. This was in North Carolina, and a really wise nurse, and we were about to drug and jump on, do all kinds of things because it was really getting out of control. This is when I was an intern at Dorothea Dix Hospital in North Carolina. And this really wise nurse just told me and everybody else to back the blank up. I mean, she said it nicely and with a little wink on her face. And she just walked up to the lady and said, "Ma'am, your hair, it's all messed up." A lady, you can't be presenting yourself with your hair this way. And so she was able to hear that. So in addition to the hallucinations and the dragons and the things that might have been impinging upon her mind and hurting her, she also heard the compassion. And there was a human part of her that heard the lady talking about fixing her hair. And that part calmed down. There are catatonic people who simply can't hear you. There are delirious people who they're so far gone that there's nothing that you say or do that can hear you. But you know, you kind of don't want to be the one that was mean and thinking the person can't understand you when they wake up a month or two later and say, "You know what? I heard every dang thing you said, and stop calling me names, you son of a bitch." You know, so you don't want to be that person. You have to maintain the view that people can get better. And I even think, as you know, you're putting people down for surgery with anesthesia, we need to be gentle as that happens.
Yeah. So you mentioned there the idea that, yeah, when speaking in front of people, and I don't know if it's true, but you often hear the idea that, yeah, people have rated what they're most afraid of, and death comes in on second place after speaking in public, which is the main fear of people. But I was wondering how much of mental suffering comes down to feeling unsafe, being essentially afraid as an organism that is mortal on this planet, being afraid of, being unsafe, being in danger of, I suppose, dying ultimately. How much suffering comes down to that? Because I know myself that the stress response, the fight or flight limbic response in our bodies is designed to keep us alive, and it's evolved under very harsh circumstances. And yeah, for anyone who has had a panic attack, it can truly feel like you are in lethal danger. And there's just something about that response that is inherently, everything is so extremely important, and it feels extremely dangerous when you have that panic attack. And I've personally, I don't really want to say this on air, but I will. When I was feeling the worst psychologically and physiologically in my life, I've once had a panic attack trying to figure out the best workout routine, and having a panic between how to split the days and how many sets to do. I was really into that shit, and I mean, I was in no danger whatsoever. But would you say that the ultimate thing there is that I think I'm in danger? And that's why I get the panic response. Like, we're all afraid of dying and we don't know how to deal with that, essentially. Unconsciously, a lot of the time, though. But does that make any sense?
It does, except to say that in our field, at least some of those episodes to be defined as a panic attack, and there are reasons for that having to do with which drugs and which therapies work, that the panic has to be, at least to some extent, seemingly at least, out of the blue, not precipitated by a particular thought. And the reason that's so is if a panic attack is always precipitated by a thought, just functionally we know that certain drugs won't work. It's a different sort of effect. The out of the blue panic in which you go outside and then the learning goes the other way. You go outside, you have a panic attack, and then you're crossing a bridge. And so you might say, "Oh my goodness, bridges are bad." And then you cross the road and you have a panic attack. "Oh my goodness, roads are bad." Until finally, an individual becomes stuck in the home. And that becomes panic with agoraphobia. Now, panic and agoraphobia are nowadays separate diagnoses for better or worse in the DSM. I don't know quite why they did that. Presumably they're because people separately have them, or there are panic variants maybe that don't quite meet criteria for a panic attack that go with agoraphobia, which is this pervasive fear that causes people often to not leave their homes. But I think there is something to that. There's a visceral something or other that's happening in at least the unconscious mind. I mean, the body is, in effect, preparing to die. Why do you feel butterflies in your stomach when you're nervous? Why? Because blood flow isn't going to one's stomach. So consequently, there are unusual sensations that come. That's butterflies. And without meaning to be too gross to your listeners, the anal sphincter relaxes during panic. And people think the evolutionary reason for that is that you need to empty your gut. Why is that? Because a full gut, if you get hit with a spear or attacked in the stomach, and if it penetrates your gut, you're pretty much dead, at least before modern medicine, because the bacteria...
Sepsis?
Yeah, well, the bacteria... Well, peritonitis. I mean, yes, sepsis, but the bacteria from your gut would get into your peritoneum, which is a sterile cavity. So even if you had a hole in your peritoneum, you might not die if it didn't penetrate your gut. But once it penetrates your gut, you're dead, and so you evacuate. And then why is it that your muscles tense? Well, your muscles tense because you're creating kind of body armor.
Yeah.
To protect against attack. And why is it that your heart races? And why is there what's called gluconeogenesis? You're creating more sugar for rapid metabolizing glycogen into glucose. You're creating the physiological products that are needed to oxygenate the blood more and to fight to save your life. So in a modern day and age, we don't need to do that. And so we have butterflies because we're not running around fighting. It's when genetic history and the knowledge that evolved in genes is in conflict with our conscious mind, which says there is no reason to actually fight. Therein lies many of the differences and difficulties between the unconscious mind and the conscious mind. We talked about last time how it must be the case that since babies are not blank slates, the genes have some knowledge of how to, in some way, put into a baby's mind the ability to interpret sensations in a particular way, which is why babies uniformly are fearful when they're separated from their mother, or almost uniformly. And babies at a certain point in life will be uncomfortable when you squeeze their arm. Now, if it were all just high-level interpretation, some babies around the world would think that when you slapped them in the face, it felt good, and they would enjoy it rather than not enjoy it. And universally, babies are hungry and feel suffering, ultimately, when they're not eating. And the uniformity of that is due to our genes' ability to put into our mind the ability to interpret sensations in a particular way. Now, that doesn't mean, as we talked about last time, that we can't override them. But it does mean, as you pointed out last time, that it can't be immediate. It might be fast, but as long as the gene has the ability to do that, and as long as we haven't surgically eliminated it, that the genes have the ability to do this indefinitely, and people who claim otherwise must, in a sense, believe in a blank slate. Now, some people will say, well, one can quickly do something about that, so they won't deny what I'm saying. But they will say that then you can do something quickly about it. But we might disagree about how quickly it can be done, whether it can be easily done for everyone, and whether for some people that genetic influence is more profound and more complicated to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, so Michael, I thought we could end on what do we know about sleep? How important is that for mental well-being? And yeah, how do you think about that?
It's a huge, huge topic, and it's a field of specialty in both in psychiatry, in neurology, and in pulmonary medicine, interestingly. What we know is that there are a variety of different fascinating sleep disorders. A good night's sleep is very important, But interestingly, too much or too little can be a problem, and it varies dramatically. A good rule of thumb is if you wake up refreshed and energized, then regardless of the amount of sleep that one is having, one is doing relatively well. You know, it's very interesting. Many of us have been on call, for example, and slept very little, and there's a certain kind of giddiness that we feel in the morning virtually all of the time. It's often an irritable giddiness. Somehow, in patients with bipolar disease, that continues, and it becomes kind of a hyperactivity. And interestingly, before we had antidepressants, people used to and still do to some extent, sleep, believe it or not, deprivation therapy, and people who are sleeping too much with their depression in order to help elevate the mood. There is something fascinating about sleep-wake cycles. It's a major topic in and of itself. I mean, parasomnia is the type of disorders one has when one is sleeping, the sleepwalking, sleep terrors, REM behavioral disorder, seizures during sleep. Fascinating topics because it gets at the interface between biological and psychological factors.
I know you've told me that when people show psychotic symptoms at your clinic, one of the first things you do to screen out is to make sure that they aren't severely sleep deprived, because that can actually mimic the symptoms of psychosis.
Yeah, and invariably, people who are manic and psychotic, it's quite difficult to tell the difference between someone who is just having, say, a psychotic break in schizophrenia versus someone who is manic, not sleeping for weeks on end. And it can be quite difficult to tell the difference. And it's not immediately clear when one looks at various genetic markers that those are two separate disorders, bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, but we think they are, and I think they are too, at least in some respects clinically, I think they are. When things are really crazy, the first thing is we get somebody to have a reasonable night's sleep. We get them to be calm. Then we help them to think more clearly and happily. And then, at least when I do things, help them later to feel more awake, alert. But the first thing is to stop the agitation and help people to calm down, because when people are agitated and miserable is really when they kill themselves. And so that's why emphasizing a really good night's sleep and avoiding drugs and other sorts of things which would interfere with that is a key part of good mental health.
How about something like the vagus nerve and intervention that stimulate that?
One of the treatments for major depression in patients who are refractory is a vagal nerve stimulator that people use. And it's true that people with major depression have what's called, to use maybe simplistic terminology, lower heart period variability, which is to say that when the heart rate is overly rigid, that demonstrates a preponderance of fight or flight activation to the heart relative to parasympathetic or vagal stimulation. And greater heart period variability is safer and better both for your heart, and it correlates with one's mental health. Many antidepressants increase heart period variability, particularly during stress and mental stress. Various activities can induce increasing vagal tone. Interventions that increase vagal tone can help people with a variety of different conditions and seizures, major depression, so much so that the FDA has approved it for the treatment of major depression.
All right, Michael. Once again, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I learn a lot each time, and seems to be an inexhaustible source of interesting conversation having you on the podcast. But thanks a lot, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Christopher. I completely enjoyed being here with you.